Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
Please turn to Deuteronomy chapter 2. We'll join Moses' account in verse 1, where he writes, "Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness of the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and we skirted Mount Seir for many days." Now that many days, that's 38 years. That is many days. Plus about a year before they started wandering in the wilderness, when they had received the Ten Commandments and built the tabernacle. And so by now, it's about 39 years plus, and they're going to start heading back to the Promised Land. So they had kept wandering aimlessly, not getting anywhere, skirting this mountain all this time, just waiting until the unbelieving generation died in the wilderness, so that all those who were old enough to comprehend what was going on, so to speak, those to whom the Ten Commandments was given, those to whom was given the command to enter into the Promised Land and take the Promised Land, so that all those folks would die. And symbolically, the lesson learned is that those to whom the Ten Commandments was given, they died in the wilderness. They never entered the Promised Land. But their little ones did. The law kills, but God gives life. Verse 2, "And the Lord spoke to me, saying, 'You have skirted this mountain long enough. Turn northward.' So God says, 'Let's get going. Your older generation has died off. Let's head back to the Promised Land, and I will carry you across the threshold.'" Verse 4, "And God commanded the people, saying, 'You are about to pass through the territory of your brethren, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir, S-E-I-R, and they will be afraid of you. Therefore, watch yourselves carefully. Do not meddle with them, for I will not give you any of their land, no, not so much as one footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession.'" Now Esau, that's Jacob's twin brother, who sold his birthright for some red stew. And in so doing, he became a type of Adam, and Jacob a type of Christ. For Jesus stole Adam's birthright. For to Adam rightly belongs the judgment of the world. Yet Christ took that upon himself, and he became the new head of the human race. So, since he became identified with that red stew transaction, Esau's name was changed to Edom, which means red, and he became the father of the Edomites, and that is who the Israelites now would pass by. By the way, Esau typified Adam, and Edom is the same word as Adam. No difference in the original Hebrew. And when you pass these Edomites, these descendants of Esau, then verse 6, "You shall buy food from them with money that you may eat, and you shall also buy water from them with money that you may drink." In other words, just don't take from them as you will take from the Canaanites. Oh, and by the way, notice that food and water, they're not fundamental rights, but if you don't have food and water, you have to buy it with money. Liberals would do well to take note of that. But back to this verse here, "These Edomites, they are your distant relatives, and I have given them their land, just as I will give you your land." And they're distant relatives because Jacob entered Egypt as an old man with his sons and grandsons, 67 of them altogether, to join Joseph and his two sons, making 70 Jews in Egypt a few centuries earlier. Now, Jacob's brother Esau, his descendants did not enter Egypt. So the two nations grew separately, related but separate and distant. Now, Israel is passing by Edom on their way back to Canaan. much like Jacob had to pass by Esau on his way back to Canaan after his long stay with Laban north of Canaan in Haran. And as it was a tense moment for Jacob, there was tension these centuries later also. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Verse 7, "For the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hand. He knows you're trudging through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you, you have lacked nothing." So God provided for them all those years. So Moses is saying, don't think you will need to take anything from these distant relatives of yours. Trust God. Now, Moses tells us that they did pass by Esau's land, verse 8, "And when we passed beyond our brethren, the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir, away from the road of the plain, away from Elath and Ezion-Geber, we turned and passed by the way of the wilderness of Moab." Now, Ezion-Geber, that's at the north end of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is just about 100 miles due south of the Dead Sea. Then they went north from there through Moab, where Lot's descendants lived. Now remember that Abraham's brother, Haran, had a son named Lot. And in a drunken stupor, Lot committed incest. And as the Canaanites had been produced a few centuries earlier by incest, so too Lot produced the Moabites and the Ammonites. The Ammonites settled just north of the Moabites, both of these groups to the east of Israel. Moab was in the south around the area of the Dead Sea, in the mountains east of the sea, and in the plains around it. Today, Jordan, the country of Jordan, includes the ancient lands of Moab and Ammon. Now, their wilderness wanderings ended in the plains of Moab across the Jordan from Jericho. That's where they ended. Oh, and by the way, does secular archaeology confirm that these nations existed, the Moabites and the Ammonites and, let's say, this ancient city of Jericho? Absolutely. Archaeology history confirms these places. By contrast, does archaeology confirm the existence of any of the cities mentioned in the Book of Mormon? No, it doesn't. Not a one. The difference between history, actual history being recorded, and fantasy, mythology being invented. Verse 9, "Then the Lord said to me, 'Do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession.'" Now, Ar, that's the name of a city, a region. "The river Arnon, A-R-N-O-N, watered the land of Moab, and their city of Aror, A-R-O-E-R. Numbers 22 speaks of the city of Ar, and in the Greek Septuagint, we read the Areopolis. So God says, "I have given Ar, A-R." That appears to refer generally to the land of Moab and to a principal river and city. Over the rest of this chapter, we have references to the giants in the land. Like the Nephilim and the Anakim that we are more familiar with, we also learn of the Emim, also called Horites, the Zamzumim, and the Avim. And while not in this chapter, but elsewhere, we read of the Rephaim. These are the names the locals used to describe the giants in their land. Again, as we mentioned in the last chapter, in our Genesis, the Flood study album, we discuss these giants at length. No pun intended. Ancient mythology of the gods having human offspring was very persistent. Half human, half divine creatures, always springing from a divine father, a supernatural father, and a human mother. And why is it that way? Why was it never the other way around? Why wasn't the father human and he has a relationship with the goddess? If men are just inventing these stories out of thin air, why not invent it that way? Seem more interesting, more braggadocious to the men inventing the stories. But these persistent myths, these Greek myths, Egyptian, Roman myths, were perversions of a historical reality recorded without embellishment in the Bible, that there were giants in the land, and those giants came from when, as we read in Genesis 6, the sons of God, the fallen angels, saw the daughters of men and had relations with them and produced the Nephilim, giants. And that happened before the flood and later after the flood, as Genesis 6 tells us. Verse 10, the Emim had dwelt there in times past, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. They were also regarded as giants, like the Anakim, but the Moabites called them Emim. So the giants called Emim dwelt in Moab. Verse 12, the Horites formerly dwelt in Seir, but the descendants of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and dwelt in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. Now that's quite a sentence, but it mentions the Horites. Hor means cave, and thus these Emim are called cave dwellers here. But now I want to talk about the part of the verse that says that the Edomites dispossessed these giants, just as Israel did to those who had the promised land. The Jews, over the next century or so, dispossessed many of the Canaanites from their lands. Well, if Moses wrote this, how could he have known that? Because he died before the Jews entered into the promised land and before they dispossessed them, the peoples who lived there. Well, Moses wrote Deuteronomy, and the book of Deuteronomy ends with the description and account of Moses' own death. And we can easily see that Joshua was Moses' right-hand man. He took Moses' mantle, so to speak, after him, his staff, his authority. And then Joshua, or one of his scribes, would edit the end of Deuteronomy, appending to it the account of Moses' death. So too, the same men, under inspiration of God, could add this note here, that just as the Israelites destroyed the people in Canaan, so too the Edomites destroyed the Emim. Verse 13, now rise and cross over the valley of the Zered. So we crossed over the valley of the Zered. Now Zered is a river to the southeast of the Dead Sea, flowing into it as the Jordan does from the north. You know, the rivers did not create the sea, but rather the deepness of the area of the Dead Sea created the rivers as a natural drainage basin, being the lowest point on the earth, on the land, on continental earth. Of course, in the Pacific Ocean, you have the Mariana Trench, and that's deeper, but that's in the ocean. The Dead Sea is the lowest point on earth, on land. And if hell is in the center of the earth, then there in Israel, you can get closer to hell than anywhere else on earth. And that being the site of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And by the way, if you've ever been there, you know what an utterly miserable and foreboding realm it is, the closest approximation to hell we'll ever see on earth. Verse 14, in the time we took to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over the valley of the Zered was 38 years. 38 years until all the generation of the men of war was consumed from the midst of the camp, just as the Lord had sworn to them. Again, Kadesh stood at the threshold of the land of Canaan if you're coming in from the south, as they were 38 years earlier. 38 years earlier, they were returning to Canaan by the same route that Jacob had entered into Egypt, pretty much just going back. But they never entered in because of their unbelief. So they wandered for 38 years. And then they took some time to battle a bit against the Amorites and some last minute details before entering into the promised land. So a generation later, they're returning to the promised land, but not by that direct route, by a much more circuitous route from the east. They now need to cross the Jordan River opposite Jericho. That's where they're headed now. Verse 15. For indeed the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from the midst of the camp until they were consumed. that is the older generation. So it was when all the men of war had finally perished from among the people that the Lord spoke to me, saying, this day you are to cross over at Ar, the boundary of Moab. Now remember, Lot had two children by his two daughters. The older daughter bore him Moab, and the younger bore him Ammon. Lot's other descendants, they're the Ammonites, they dwelt in the land north of the river Arnon. So God said to Israel, today you cross over at Ar, the boundary, that is the northern boundary of Moab. Verse 19. And when you come near the people of Ammon, do not harass them or meddle with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the descendants of Lot as a possession. Verse 20, that was also regarded as a land of giants. Giants formerly dwelt there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before them, and they dispossessed them and dwelt in their place, just as he had done for the descendants of Esau, who dwelt in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them. They dispossessed them and dwelt in their place even to this day. Now, I'd like to speak briefly about this group of people, the Horites, and another name we find in the Bible, the Hivites. These two names are extremely similar in Hebrew. The Greek Septuagint, that's the Old Testament Hebrew translated into Greek, sometimes substitutes the name Horite for Hivite. They're so similar in the Hebrew. What does that tell us? Well, there were a nation of people that intermingled with the Canaanites. They're well known to the secular world of history. That nation was called the Hurrians. And I believe that's who the Horites were. And very possible also the Hivites, the same people. Very similar Hebrew names, just slight variations in the names. The Hurrians had dealings with the pharaohs of Egypt. When the Bible mentions the ancient Hivites, I think it's referring to these Hurrians, because that would make sense. Also, the Bible calls the giants of Moab Horites, cave dwellers. And it could be that it's referring to these two different groups of people by the same name. The giants are being called Horites because they're cave dwellers, whereas these people dwelling in Canaan, they're being called Horites because they're Hurrians or Horites. Verse 23, and the Avim, who dwelt in villages as far as Gaza, you know, the Gaza Strip today, same place, the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and dwelt in their place. Now, Kaphtor, that's the place of origin of the Philistines. It's called Kephtiu in Egyptian inscriptions, and it's called Kaptara in cuneiform texts. That likely refers to the island of Crete, and thus the Philistines, as evidence points to, were a seafaring people. Their god, Dagon, was a half-fish, half-man, who once lost his human head over the Ark of the Covenant. Now, these Avim giants dwelt in Gaza, where the five cities of the Philistines were located. And so the Philistines had destroyed the Avim, but not the Anakim. Rather, they formed an alliance with the Anakim, and one of their descendants, Goliath, battled and he lost against young David, who later went on to cleanse the land. That was a good form of ethnic cleansing, to clear the land of the Anakim, the giants. Now back to the narrative, verse 24. Rise, take your journey, and cross over the river Arnon. Look, I have given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to possess it and engage him in battle. The Amorites were pagan descendants of Shem. They were desert nomads, first living in the east, perhaps Iraq or Saudi Arabia, and then migrating into Canaan. The Amorites were named not for their ancestors, but for their deity, Martu. Martu means the leveler of cities and destroyer of peoples. His name, Martu, their name of the god, was the same as the epithet used to describe a ruthless conqueror. Perhaps, anciently, that name of their god came from the flood, the sea, Martu, you know, fruta de mar, the fruit of the sea, the seafood, maritime law, Martu, the flood. Noah's flood was the leveler of cities and the destroyer of peoples. And that might be where their God came from. At any rate, a nation like the Assyrians, who destroyed cities and peoples, could be called Amorites, Martu, from Martu, functioning in latter days as the flood had done previously. Now, the Amorites lived both east and west of the Jordan River. This king Sihon, living in Heshbon, in the land of Ammon, he lived about a dozen miles east of the north tip of the Dead Sea. Other Amorites lived in Judea, especially in the area between Jerusalem and Gaza. Verse 25, "This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you." Now, Israel was to take the promised land and destroy it or dispossess the Canaanites who dwelt there. And so if all went as planned, those nations would dread them. But all did not go as planned, and Israel did not fully occupy the land, and so they had to live with their enemies among them, getting them into the exact same problem that Israel faces today with the Palestinians. Millennia ago, these different peoples were nations, but today's Palestinians, they were never a nation. Before Israel regained her statehood in 1948, there never had been a Palestinian state. There were no borders, no king, no government, no legislature, constitution, no coin or currency. There just was never a Palestinian state. But Israel had a state that gave way 2,000 years ago to the Roman Empire that destroyed her in AD 70. So the Palestinian refugees, they were created in 1948 when Israel was declared a nation. And five Arab armies attacked, driving tens of thousands of Palestinians from their homes. Those Palestinians, they were cheering the oncoming Arab armies, hoping that they would drive the Jews into the sea and destroy Israel on the day of her rebirth. But rather, as the Judeo-Christian West will always do, Israel won. And those who were later called Palestinians, they lost. The Arabs created the Palestinian refugee crisis, not Israel. Yet no Arab country is willing to absorb these people into their mostly empty lands. If they loved and valued their Arab brethren and saw them as human assets, then Jordan, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Egypt would try to lure them into their own lands. But rather, they see them as pawns. They use them as miserable tokens to aid the political battle against Israel. Now in the text, verse 26, Moses says, "And I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, 'Let me pass through your land. I will keep strictly to the road, and I will turn neither to the right nor to the left. You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot.'" Now remember, the Jews had sacked the wealth of Egypt on their way out, and with a couple military conquests in the wilderness, they were not without monetary resources. So Moses says to the Amorites, "Hey, do like Moab and the Edomites did. For, verse 29, just as the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir and the Moabites who dwell in Ar did for me until I crossed the Jordan to the land which the Lord our God is giving us, do like they did. Just sell me food and water." By the way, notice, "sell me food and give me water for money." Liberals think people have a right to take water and take food. Of course, that's not true. If you need food and water, you buy it with money. Verse 30. "But Sihon, king of Heshbon, would not let us pass through, for the Lord your God hardened his heart and made his heart obstinate, that he might deliver him into your hand as it is this day." We'll talk about that when we get to the end of the story about his heart being hardened. "And the Lord said to me, 'See, I have begun to give Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to possess it that you may inherit his land.' Then Sihon and all his people came out against us to fight at Jahaz. And the Lord our God delivered him over to us. So we defeated him, his sons, and all his people. We took all his cities at that time, and we utterly destroyed the men, women, and little ones of every city. We left none remaining." Killing women and children, that's what we call terrorism, right? So how could God possibly command the Jews to do that? Verse 35, We took only the livestock as plunder for ourselves, with the spoil of the cities which we took, from Arar, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, and from the city that is in the ravine, as far as Gilead, there was not one city too strong for us. The Lord our God delivered all to us. Now God did not protect these Amorites from Moses, as he did the descendants and relatives of Abraham, like the Edomites, Moabites, and Ammonites. Rather, these Amorites, named after their pagan deity, as far as God was concerned, it was open season on them. Kill them, these wicked people, and end their reign of wickedness in the land. Yeah, but kill the children? Well, unbelievers use these kinds of passages in the Bible to condemn the God of the Bible. They say he's immoral. By the book you Christians claim, show that your God is immoral. But ask them this. If a creator makes creatures to live life in two stages, stage one and stage two, wouldn't the creator have the right to bring his creatures from stage one to stage two if he chose to? If he made us to live, let's say, first on the porch and then to enter into the living room, could it possibly be wrong for him to bring us from the porch to the living room? Of course not. God has all authority to bring a human being from this life to the next. And if he wants to delegate that authority and order other human beings like Moses or Joshua to kill human beings, be they men, women, or children, then God has the authority to do that rightly. And if they be children, then they go into his arms. And if they be unrepentant adults, then they go to the destination of their choice, an eternal abode apart from God. Regarding God's hardening of King Sihon's heart, we saw this in detail in our Exodus study, and we will see it again in our Romans study. God hardened Pharaoh's heart, not by sprinkling some chemical agent on him, not by physically or even supernaturally hardening his heart, but psychologically by revealing God's greatness. That played to Pharaoh's pride. And whenever God did a miracle, Pharaoh hardened his heart, giving God the opportunity to bring about his purpose. The same thing is happening here with Sihon, although we don't have all the details we had with the plagues of the Exodus. And when God instructs Moses to go humbly to King Sihon and say, please let us pass through, we'll buy food and water with our money, God knows that Sihon would view that as weakness, and it would harden his heart. Now, there are some people who believe in free will, Christians, who think that, well, at times, God violates someone's free will. Now, that's a logical absurdity. You cannot possibly violate someone's free will. Then it's no longer free. It's not their will. You can, of course, overpower a man physically. You can use his finger to pull a trigger to kill someone. However, you didn't violate his free will. You simply compelled his physical body, which is a matter of the laws of physics. However, you could never make him will to kill someone against his will. It's a logical impossibility. Now, the last verse of the chapter, only you did not go near the land of the people of Ammon, those now distant relatives of Abraham, anywhere along the river Jabbok or to the cities of the mountains or wherever the Lord our God had forbidden us. We went and attacked where we were told to attack, and we had mercy where we were told to have mercy.